Okay, I thank the organizer for having me here. And this morning, I would like to talk to you about a recent work which I've done in collaboration with Junhong Han, who is here, and also Changhua Wan. He's a visiting scholar from Nanjing University in China. First of all, the basis of my work, is largely follow the footsteps of many of your works here, and I just, since the time will be short, I wouldn't be able to, reference you one by one, but I just want to tell you.
That way we cannot think that we can work in
technology. Yeah, I acknowledge your efforts. Okay. So, another thing which I want to say at the beginning is that if the Kupre were a horse, I'm not terribly sure what my picture would be better than this. Okay. With all this said, let's begin. For a lantern cuprate systems, apparently the following ordering tendencies, I emphasize the word tendencies, are observed. For doping, which is sufficiently small, we have antiferromagnetism, and this ordering tendency apparently lasts until zero temperature and the system form a phase, a thermodynamic phase which has antiferromagnetic Lorentz order. And for doping, which is somewhere intermediate, we see the ordering tendency of stripes. And here we are really talking about ordering tendencies because at the lowest energy, we don't see a static version of this order. And we also see, because in this doping range, the system exhibits superconductivity, so we see the stripe ordering tendency coexisting with pairing. And then for large enough doping, we see a uniform state where the density is homogeneous and the system shows D-wave pairing. With this, the above wide variety of ordering tendencies, a obvious question to ask is what microscopic model is capable of describing them. In this talk, I would like to preach that the TGM model plus cooling interaction is a good candidate for this model. I add cooling interaction not to complicate the issues. I personally think the cooling interaction is an essential ingredient of the model. Here I've wrote down the TGM model plus cooling interaction in the so-called auxiliary boson, slave boson representation, where B are the slave boson and F are the fermion. In the literature, they are sometimes called honan and spinon. And the cooling interaction I switch on is a genuine 1 over R interaction. The parameter I'm going to study is J over T equal to 3, and the nearest neighbor cooling strength versus T T is equal to 5.
Is it important to
know the order interaction? That's a good question. Let me remind me this question later. Come back. Now, this model is supplemented with a constraint which says that on every side, the number of boson plus the number of fermion is equal to 1. To tell you the truth, the difficulty in solution of this model is often blamed on this constraint, but in my opinion, even I ignore this constraint, this model is very difficult to solve. So to me, it's not totally obvious which part. Well, it's not crystally clear what's the you know, which part is due to the constraint, which part is due to the fact that this is an interacting Hamiltonian. In terms of the boson and fermion operators, we can write the electron operator. So the electron annihilation operator is equal to the product of the boson creation operator and a fermion annihilation operator. This model captured the following physics of the cuprate. The T term obviously captured the tendency to delocalize of electrons, and the J term captured the short-range anti-ferromagnetic correlation due to the mass physics, and the strong short-range repulsion is captured by the constraint that on every side we cannot put more than one electron, and the long-range charge-charge interaction is captured by the Coulomb. So what should we do with this model? Obviously, we will have no chance to solve this model. So this is our strategy. The strategy is that we will use mean field theory to address the ordering tendency of this model. So here we are talking about medium and high energy physics. And then once the mean field theory has told us what are the ordering patterns, and at the same time it implies what are the leftover soft mode. And then we will use effective field theories to describe the residual low energy degree of freedom, which is left out from the mean field theory. So this is the program.
Just the goal is to reproduce the phase diagram and the nurse phases, okay?
Correct. To see, you know, whether this model, you know, has all those, you know,
phases.
Okay, so let me begin the first step. The first step is the mean field theory. Now, if I view this, the TJ model here, which I wrote down here, as a boson fermion model, let me make a very simple variational ansatz. So I consider a wave function of the following form, where I have the bosons condensed, and I have the fermion, which is in a Slater determinant made up of Fogel-Liouville-like single particle operators. And here, I want to emphasize that we construct the Fogel-Liouville operator so that in the fermion sector, we allow not only the Hopping average, but also the magnetization average on the site. Of course, in the mean field theory, we have broken this spin rotational symmetry and just choose a given axis for the magnetization. And we also allow the pairing. And here, we condense the boson. Now, so although we do tell the system to have, for example, magnetic moment, but we absolutely do not enforce this moment to align anti-ferromagnetically. Although we do bias the system to a pairing here, but we don't tell it to pair in which symmetry. And in particular here, for every single one of these mean field order parameters, we do not tell, we do not impose any translation symmetry. So all those parameters are either site and bound dependent. So this is sort of like a no-brain, you know, a brute force search. The minimization program is the following. We take this above variational ansatz, and as usual, the constraint is only enforced on average. So we require the average of the boson and the fermion occupation number to be equal to 1, and this Lagrange multiplier, of course, is also allowed to be site dependent. And at last, there is one global Lagrange multiplier which just fixed the doping concentration, which says the average number of hole per site has to be equal to x. And therefore, this last Lagrange multiplier is a global quantity. Now, with all this vast number of parameters, we just do a brute force minimization. Obviously, we have to resort to numerical means. So we study, we perform the minimization on a n by n lattice. For a totally unbiased search, we were able to do the minimization for 16 by 16 lattice. Now, once we identify the patterns on the 16 by 16 lattice, we can do a more biased search. In that case, we can do up to 120 by 120.
A question about the density. If you have domain Coulomb interactions, essentially forcing the system to be a fixed.
Yeah.
Yeah. Why do you need to minimize another variation parameter?
Yeah, okay. No.
The density will automatically be x, the average density, because otherwise you pay an identity.
I'm sorry?
This is a 2D problem?
This is a 2D problem, yeah. Yeah, you are saying once I put the x here, the system is forced to have a density. Okay, but I guess it wouldn't hurt.
That's true.
You have to move the density, so you change the background.
Yeah.
You change the uniform background when you change your density of particles, and that's where your chemical potential does. Yeah. You have to move the Fermi surface, for example, to change the doping. You need that.
That's the answer to the problem.
It's just like putting the background charge
in
your language.
Okay,
So those are my mean field strategy, and this is the result. Okay. Now, for T over J equal to 3 and the V over J equal to 5, at so far we only have result for zero temperature.
Is T over J is 3 and
V over J is 5, yeah. Oh, sorry, I previously say V over T equal to 5, yeah.
I think J over T is 3 and
4. T over J is 3, V over J is equal to 5, that's right. Okay, now at zero temperature, the result does change quantitatively. We cannot take a too wide a range of, you know, too big a change in J. We have.
I'm not worried about J over T because that's pretty nailed the value.
The V over J is not, that's right. I don't think there is a good consensus on what V over J is.
So did you say you can't take a very wide range of V?
We didn't take a wide range of V. Yeah. I think we did study V over J equal to 3, did we?
Between V over J 5 and V over J equal to 3, there were no qualitative
change. Yeah, but the detailed numbers will of course shift. Okay, so this is the zero temperature result for zero doping. We have anti-ferromagnetic long range order. So in the language of the previous order parameters, at zero doping, of course the boson expectation is equal to zero. And the mean field theory will actually automatically give us the Harping average and the pairing average equal to zero as well. So we just have a extremely classical state. So each of the electron live in the classical magnetic mean field, live in the magnetic mean field from its four neighbors, and we have one electron per site. So this is a super naive version of the null state. And in this case, the magnetic moment per site is 100%. This is quite different from if you study the Haber model at half filling, where you don't get 100% magnetization. And the difference, we believe, is because in the TGA model, there's absolutely no charge fluctuation allowed. One thing good about this state is that the mean field state actually obeyed the occupation constraint exactly. Now, obviously,
the expectation value of the spin is a half or one
suitable
unit?
It's half, yeah.
That could just be a mean field.
Yeah, absolutely. No. Yeah. Of course, I mean, this is only a mean field theory. We subsequently will start to do the effective theory of the Goldstone mode. In that case, if you allow the mean field from its four neighbors to change slowly in space and time, then you know you end up with the effective theory for the low energy mode to be the nonlinear sigma model.
Which, they're actually equal to zero.
Which were.
So this is the solution in these fields.
Yeah.
This is wave function, the classical ground state.
Yeah, it's the classical ground state, yeah. Now, for x between 0 and 2%, we find that the holes are, the added holes are localized in certain patterns such that the pi-pi commensurate anti-ferromagnetism is not disrupted. Now, it's a heck of a difficult job to pin down exactly what pattern the hole are localized because there are a huge number of degeneracy patterns. But one thing for sure we can say is that the holes are all localized and the anti-ferromagnetism persists. We cannot say with confidence that what's the final hole configuration, namely whether it's a Wigner crystal, although I believe it should be, and what geometry it takes.
The strength of the Coulomb interaction versus the TGA, right?
Yeah.
I just looked at your mean field order parameters were for bonds and on site. So
yeah.
You're looking for uniform solutions or
no.
You're not. Looking for
So what
was being modulated in, when you're in the charge density wave?
Oh, for example, what happened is here you know, you will only have BI dagger BI not equal to zero here, and B will be zero everywhere else. So you know, wherever which is outside the little region where the hole resides, we basically get the solution of this anti-ferromagnet. And inside, the holes will get, you know, something different.
It's not that they have an expectation, but I'm just using the number, the BI is one.
Yeah.
What is the ratio of B prime will be?
T prime.
No, there's no T prime.
There's no T prime. Okay. Now, between 2 to 14%, the self-consistent solution revealed two competing stripes.
This is on 16 by 16.
This is on 16 by 16, and then once the pattern is identified, fine-tuning of the quantity can be verified by doing larger system. So between 2 to 14%, we see two competing self-consistent solutions, which we identify as two type of stripes. One is in-phase stripe, where the nail order parameter does not flip across the stripe. And the second is anti-phase, where the nail order parameter does flip. And this is an example of the stripes at filling factor doping 1/8. So in the first case, we see that we have two columns of basically unperturbed anti-ferromagnet, and then followed by a stripe then followed by two columns of unperturbed anti-ferromagnet with the nail order flipped. And inside the stripe, we have a residual magnetization, which is the this is the in-phase stripe. So the nail order parameter does not flip. inside the stripe, we have the coexistence of pairing. So here, the red and the blue bond indicate that the expectation value of f dagger are non-zero, and moreover, it is, say, equal to plus in the horizontal bond, and it is equal to minus in the vertical bond. And inside the stripe, there are some residual magnetization, which is how the entire in-phase pi-pi anti-ferrite mechanism penetrates through the stripe.
Does B have an expectation value?
Yeah, inside the stripe.
Oh, so it's
yeah.
So the holes are mobile inside.
Holes are mobile inside the stripe.
And the strengths are always bonds centered?
Yes. The stripe in this calculation turn out always to be bond centered.
Is the density in the electromagnetic region exactly one?
Yes.
Or?
Yes. It's very sharp. Now, the second type of stripe is the antiphase. The antiphase stripes is one where the nail order parameter flip by pi as we go across the stripe. And it's a surprise to us that at doping 1/8, we didn't see any detectable pairing amplitude inside the antiphase stripe at thinning pressure 1/8. This was actually contrary to what I believed early on. And inside the antiphase stripe, we also have some residual magnetization. And the magnetization inside the antiphase stripe is such that across the run, it is ferromagnetically aligned. But along the chain, it is anti-ferromagnetically aligned.
What happens if you just take your TJ model and you tell it all it is allowed to do is give you Ni up minus Ni down, I think, and density variations, and you don't allow it D-wave pairing, amplitude, or anything else. Does it reduce to the work, I guess I'm thinking of Pohl-Blanc and Rice, I'm thinking of Zanon. It seemed to me there was early partially thought calculations on trying to look at stripes.
Mm-hmm.
My memory of those is they always showed a pi phase shift
mm-hmm.
coming across them, and they showed a density profile of some
which
type,
is smooth.
And then later,
mm-hmm. yeah.
In a Gutzwiller light manipulation, Giamarchi and someone looked at it and found
mm-hmm.
it spread out a little
mm-hmm.
bit.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm wondering about is
mm-hmm.
if you were to test your procedure but
mm-hmm.
tell it can't do certain things, whether you would reproduce this. Because I find it strange
mm-hmm.
looking at the
mm-hmm.
second one
mm-hmm.
somehow that it doesn't look more like the earlier Parkey Park calculations on the models. Maybe,
okay.
maybe there's something fundamentally different.
That's a good question. I'm not actually I'm not entirely sure if I forbid everything else, just do the magnetization decoupling, I will get the Haber model result, which include a charge fluctuation. In fact, we worry, why do we get this sharp stripe, very, very much. And in fact, we have tried to improve upon this. Instead of using the Slade boson mean field theory, instead of using the Gutzwiller approximation, where we take we did a mean field theory in the framework of three bosons, which Garvey and Andre, earlier formulated. And when we did that, we did find that the profile of the stripe is smoother. It got smoother, and at filling factor 1/8, when we did that, okay, we did not find in-phase stripe self-consistent. We only find anti-phase stripe self-consistent. But we do have difficulty in carrying out that program to all doping, because when we do that calculation, because there are not a number of denominator in there, and you have to cancel one thing against another, it's very, 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 very unstable. So. So that's why I decided not to report that result. But we did, worry about all those effects a lot. Okay, here, the you know, the system will have zero holes everywhere else except inside the stripes. So
what's the concentration?
So the concentration of the holes here, I believe, is 0.2, 1/4 per side on average.
So it's only half. So how did you achieve this? Because your aquifer calculation don't you usually want to fill eigenvalues and rebuild the aquifer tank completely, and then have just have your partially filled up aquifer tank with such a solution?
But this is not exactly a Hartree-Fock calculation. This is Morris, remember that in this calculation, the fermion hopping amplitude can actually vanish because it is multiplied by Bi dagger Bj. Okay, so that's why we end up with such a sharp profile. To our surprise, we find out that the self-consistent solution is always such that, you know, there's no quantum mixing between the stripes and its environment. So Fi dagger Fj is equal to zero. I'm sorry?
You have a problem then of something like hard-core bosons hopping restricted to this ladder?
Yeah.
So why don't they order, like charge order along this direction?
That's a good question. We did not find it ordered. We did, you know, worry whether it should order or not. But
you have some kind of partially filled band structure of your own.
Yes. Yes.
Do you need some gaps?
I guess at this moment I can the honest answer is that I don't know. I mean, we didn't find it all, you know, happen.
Maybe half a hard-core boson for a run, I guess.
Yeah.
Right. Would be ordering it.
If you do think that field theory, you're going to then we have something like the perfect next
It's not the longest stride, because it's half a hard-core boson for a run of the ladder. Okay.
It's half of hardcore boson per run, that's correct.
And yeah. I guess so one would say physically that the upper state is bad for the kinetic energy because you don't have any ferromagnetic bonds there. And the T part of the Hamilton likes ferromagnetic bonds.
Yeah.
So you could see a difference in energy just from that term, from the upper configuration and the lower one.
Those things are superconducting, right?
It is.
So perhaps that.
But that T part is
much higher.
B is non-zero.
The
original argument, after all, for the interface boundary was just that it prevented the use of horizontal.
Which is not here in the calculation.
Because of the mean field.
Right. Exactly. And And in fact, I believe because of the lack of horizontal.
But you do have some sort of superconducting gap.
Right? We do.
And that's probably what prevents the modulation.
Yeah. So this one-dimensional stripe, this ladder-like object in the mean field calculation is a superconductor. Yeah. It's a. Yeah, both, but in the anti-phase case, the order parameter is very small at 1/8, but it actually grows once you go away from 1/8.
Sorry, the expectation has to be small in the anti-phase case.
Yeah. Well, we didn't try anything. We just allowed the general search. This is what the self-consistent solution.
Did you look for such a solution?
Yeah, I think we did.
See, the standard problem you have to refer to this sort of stripes is that you want to fill exactly your hydrophobic band. And your best gap is when you fill the band completely and then
empty
the gap to the next one.
Yeah.
And that automatically, in a Hartree-Fock calculation, you have one hole per side.
Yeah.
And it was only in the VM or kid calculator, which was in the future.
Yeah.
It showed the future of this in a detailed model in the VM, the future of the whole design, which is what came from it. But within simple package design, you're sort of forced to have one in which you, the stable solution is one when you, not one when you partially fill your half of the plan.
It's not a swing in terms of space, certainly, right? It's trial wave function more complicated, it's just a simple state of determinant.
But it is a way to determine that it's probably like the electrical result, but it's the issue of particular.
I think there's one way out of it, Morris, two ways out of it that Morris alluded to. One is if you opened up within this Hartree plot band, that we would have been forced to put one per site in.
Yeah.
You opened up a CDW gap.
Yeah.
Then you might do something. What Marky Sokolow and I found in generalized Hartree plot calculation, mm-hmm. the allowed D-wave current,
mm-hmm.
was that you could jimmy, we found parameters, they were pretty strange parameters,
mm-hmm.
to open up a D-wave, oh, pardon me, a superconducting gap
mm-hmm.
along that. And mm-hmm. then under those conditions, we could force that mean field solution down half a charge per unit. But as I say, that took us at least parameters such that we never decided to publish it.
Mm-hmm.
By that I mean the J was starting mm-hmm. to become comparable to the mm-hmm. U that we were mm-hmm. putting in and force mm-hmm. The D wave to come on that way.
Mm-hmm.
So mm-hmm.
I guess
surprised too that was again within this
uh-huh.
generate enough of what must be a D wave like gap, or uh-huh. pardon me, carrying gap.
Uh-huh.
To allow you to have the occupancy.
Uh-huh. In that case, you consider a short range U in hash?
Absolutely. Uh-huh. The only thing we had there was on site U and near neighbor J mm-hmm. And a near neighbor V.
Uh-huh.
Your coulomb enhances the crystallization of anything, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's why you would think the CDW would be what you'd find, but I don't know if you pull that way.
Well. Okay, the good news is that we did see the stripe, but the bad news is that we see the in-phase stripe has a lower energy than the anti-phase. But to be fair, we find that the energy difference, because both of them are self-consistent solutions, so which forces us to do a less meaningful task of comparing the energies. The energies between the in-phase and the anti-phase stripe, the difference is really minuscule. In the interval where the stripes are stable, which is, as I said, between 2 to 14%, if we subtract the energy and divide by their mean, it's about 0.1% with the in-phase stripe lowering energy at the high end of the stripe regime, and it is about 10% at the lower regime. Now, in this calculation, the mean field theory has one big drawback, that is we find the stripe always very sharp. And the quantum fluctuation or the meandering of the stripes could easily tilt this energy difference, which is not within our mean field consideration. So if we were only look at the mean field, then we are forced to say that the stripes between 2 to 14% is in-phase stripe. Now, from 14 to 25%, we find a uniform state. Yes.
Before you get on to the superconductivity, in the small superconducting state, the below the mean field theory, what are the excitations within the mean field?
Which non-superconducting state? Which
one?
Superconducting.
No. The superconducting along the state.
Yeah.
But, okay, the.
Whether or not the quantum numbers are of excitation.
Yeah, I mean in the mean field theory, we have decoupled bosons and fermions in here,
mm-hmm.
and we have boson density wave, the boson sound wave excitation, and we will have the independent you know, a fermion excitation, which will be similar to a fermion in a superconductor in a ladder. So at mean field theory, the boson fermion totally decoupled. Mm-hmm. Okay, from 14 to 25%, the self-consistent solution reveal that the density is uniform. We never find inhomogeneous solution, but even within this density range, there are two sub-range. From 14 to 20%, we find that the solution is such that the system has D-wave pairing in coexistence with a commensurate pi-pi antiferromagnetism. The residual magnetic moment is very small, but it is there in mean field theory, and the pairing is D-wave, namely it is one sign in the x direction and the other sign in the y direction. Now, if the doping concentration keep on increasing beyond 20%, then the residual antiferromagnetic order completely disappear, and the system become a genuine D-wave superconducting state. And this state is completely the state which Collier and Liu were looking at. Now, for if we still increase x further on, eventually the pairing amplitude also disappear, and the system in mean field theory become a Fermi liquid. And here are some of the details of the order parameter in mean field theory, but I basically has verbally report the result to you. Okay, here is the summary of the mean field result. Okay, the mean field theory captures states ranging from completely localized in the case of doping between 0 to 2% to completely itinerant for doping between 14 to 25%. What's intervening between them is the stripes, which is a space inhomogeneous mixture of the two. We have inside the stripes, we have the, basically the realization of this state, and inside the antiferromagnetic region, we have the realization of the other state. From mean field theory, the origin of pairing seems to be relatively clear. Of course, the pairing is due to the competition between T and J, but obviously, J is very important for pairing. If it were not because of J, they wouldn't open up a big pairing gap. The larger the J we tune, you know, if we can try to maximize the pairing energy scale, the larger the J is, the more we encourage microscopic separation of phase, because J would like to expel the host. And the Coulomb interaction, of course, prohibits this separation. And in this mean field theory, Coulomb interaction play a very important role in stabilizing a uniform high pairing scale superconducting phase between 14 to 25%. And as a byproduct, it in the intermediate, it also produces stripes. As far as we can see, inside the in-phase stripes, basically it's this superconducting state got confined in the one-dimensional geometry.
Question? I mean, you mentioned that the Fermi liquid is a phase that you get to about
25%. 25, yeah.
I'm a little concerned. I mean, if you just look at the wave function that you have, mm-hmm. it looks like it's a spin charge separation, mm-hmm. even in the liquid.
Yeah, yeah. Right. No.
And that, it's because of that you built that into the wave function, why it likes to be superconducting so much.
I agree. You know, from mean field theory, when I say Fermi liquid, I was only referring to the fermion sector. Of course, you know, in mean field theory.
Fermions, right? They're in a, and then your boson is condensed, so, right?
Right, no, they, sorry, they are not the spinners for me. What do you mean by?
Spinful charge, yeah. So it's not a fermi liberator.
Yeah,
it's
no,
spin charge liberator.
Yeah, yeah. It's totally, yeah, yeah.
But what do you say that if the models are from the system?
Well, they
all practical correlation functions are computed.
Just look at the, I mean, the wave function, not a lot of things.
If you compute the discontinuity, I mean, if you compute the all the electronic correlation functions, you need to theory look like a fermi liquid.
But what are the excitations? Can't you just
the
add
excitations are quasi-particles, FB. The electron needs F times the condensate.
Well, we can use a lot of excitations.
Yeah. But
so the initial electron, you have the
yeah.
You just have F times L,
yeah.
Right? You're
yeah.
Just adding an F times.
Yeah, yeah. That's true. Yeah, from
so
infield to
pairs of Fs.
I can just put in an F
part.
Or
you have to
make
sure
it's
not
enough
for F.
People have done,
I mean, this is all work many years ago. I mean, people have computed lots of correlation functions. Basically, you can sort of find some control parameter and study physical observables. If you're careful in not basically keeping the constraints, what you find is that all the excitations are consistent with Fermi liquid. And they're just given by particles. Of course, if you put things that violate the constraint, then of course you can get things.
The constraint is not implemented in the field theory. It's only on average. So you're somehow allowed to do that. And you just, I mean, if you solve it exactly, you know, maybe it will be a Fermi liquid out there. If you actually impose that constraint in the hard way, correct?
No,
we don't know.
If you interpret properly what this wave function is telling you, then it is giving you all the indications that this is a Fermi liquid.
Yeah. Well,
exactly. Mm-hmm. You have to always compute the invariant observable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean,
B F diagram.
Yeah, but you know, I think in principle, you know, if I just look at the thermodynamic, quantity, I mean, certainly the excitation spectrum is richer than that of the Fermi nuclei. I have decoupled, boson sector and fermion sector. The fermion sector will have exactly
yeah,
the same.
Is only at the mean field.
right. That's what he's talking. Yeah, that's what he's talking about.
Let's
I think
compute
both agree.
Let's compute an observable. Let's compute the specific heat. It will
right.
be dominated by the fermions, which have linear term, and then the boson, the fluctuations of the bosons, manage to reproduce the zero sum mode.
That still doesn't tell you that it's in the same phase as the conventional Fermi liquid.
I say, I mean, this is an approximate calculation. The question is how you interpret that. So you can, as I said, you can, for example, set up a model in a large N expansion, and you compute physical observable correlation functions, and you can see what they look like. Every single correlation function looks like that of a Fermi liquid.
No, but it's an approximation which, in the mean field level, I think the properties of the antiferromagnet are conventional, and we agree with what everyone thinks of an antiferromagnet. The properties of these striped superconductors are what a conventional striped superconductor is. The properties of this Fermi liquid are unconventional within the mean field theory. So they're not all, and I mean,
this is just semantics, because all he's presented is calculations of energies, okay? But then we have to discuss how we compute observables and correlation functions. And then you have to be careful. I agree that you can make mistakes in those calculations which have been made in the past. But if you're careful with it and you sort of keep track of the constraint and all the gauge invariants of the theory, you can get things which have the Fermi liquid form.
I guess the following statement is true, that if I just take the self-consistent mean field Hamiltonian, ignore the gauge field, therefore I don't impose the constraint. The action looked like that of two decoupled boson and fermion, and I wouldn't call that the action of a conventional fermi liquid.
Yeah, but that's not the right action. It's only mean field.
That no,
yeah, yeah,
the gauge field fluctuations that maybe
yeah,
combine
yeah, exactly,
together is
yeah.
extremely non-trivial, right?
Yeah.
And that's
right.
That physics
yeah.
is not in.
Yeah. No, no, it's not. The, yeah, yeah, it's not in the mean
right.
field.
But you can get it in one bag.
Again, but the question is, what are you trying to do? He's trying to estimate energies, okay? For the purpose of estimating energies, this is a correct procedure. Now, then the next question is, how do you compute correlation functions? And there, of course, you have to keep track of the gauge invariants. And if you do, So what happened?
I think given that it's Fermi liquid, it's spin charge separated, and spin charge separation tends to enhance superconductivity, my feeling is that this mean field theory strongly overemphasizes tendencies towards superconductivity.
That's true.
Whereas if one had a mean field theory that actually gave one a real Fermi liquid, right, and that was actually competing with a metal, right? You know, then one would see maybe that has lower energy. And one would just try a steady determinant of electrons. What can we see? You can have that energy.
How much time
do you have? You're suggesting that there's a better mean field theory.
No, I'm just saying that.
Found no evidence for flux phases in these calculations?
No. No, in fact, I mean, all the parameters allow, you know, flux phase and so on.
Well, in some sense, the uniform D wave state, you can think of that as a flux phase.
Question?
Yeah.
The previous sentence you said that the origin of failing was J.
Yeah.
At least within the mean field scheme, what are you pairing?
I'm pairing the fermions, the spin-carrying object.
So it's pairing of this F
right.
To the
correct.
Mean field,
correct.
And not
correct.
Necessarily pairing of physical
electrons. No. Okay, so this is the mean field result, and as I stated at the beginning, this is the mean field theory is attempt to address the medium to high energy ordering tendencies. And once the ordering pattern is identified, we would want to address the low energy physics by looking at the effective field theories. And because the identification of the soft mode rely on the mean field theory, so mean field theory still serve as a very important tool to identify what are the low energy degree of freedoms. Okay. So now let's talk about the fluctuations. First, let me say in the range of x between starting from zero. We were able to look at low energy soft fluctuation between 0 to 2%. That's sort of trivial because there we have localized the holes and we have antiferromagnetism. And then from 14 to 25%, the system is uniform, which we can make some progress. In the intermediate range between 2 to 14%, where we have stripes, the density or the inhomogeneously, there we haven't been able to address the low energy physics, mostly because of here we have the possibility of the geometric shapes of the stripe can fluctuate, and we can have all kind of defect, and that low energy theory so far is not within our hand. Okay, so first, let me talk about the fluctuations from 0 to 2%. There, the classical state actually, oh, by the way, I should mention that on this spectrum, in increasing x, the double occupancy constraint is actually not violated in the antiferromagnetic state, because actually the mean field solution has exactly one electron per site. Now, the double occupancy constraint is badly violated here because the charge spread all over the place. Actually, in the middle, as far as the constraint is concerned, is violated in between these two limits. In the antiferromagnetic regime, it's not violated, but inside the metallic river, it is. So from the constraint point of view, it's sort of makes sense to first look at these two extreme limits. But of course, the soft stripe meandering mode might bring in some new physics, which we were not able to handle. Okay, so again, back to the antiferromagnetism. The mean field theory satisfies the constraint has one electron per site. Now, imagine when you do the mean field calculation, you allow the magnetic mean field to slowly fluctuate over space and time. And then you can easily construct the effective field theory for that, and that's the Fermilian nonlinear sigma model. And this model, in a two space dimension at zero temperature, we know that for a sufficiently big Ks, it orders. Now, for the doping range from 14% to 25%, as I said, the constraint is barely violated. But let me first concentrate on the regime in this doping where I don't have any residual anti-ferromagnetic order. Remember that in this regime, there's a subdomain which has the coexisting D-wave pairing and the anti-ferromagnetism. Then it's followed by a domain without the anti-ferromagnetism. So for simplicity, I first concentrate on the later domain. There, the only mean field order parameter are, if you remember, the Hopping average Fi dagger Fj and the pairing average Fi dagger Fj dagger, and also the boson average B. And the Lagrange multiplier will take some uniform value. Okay. Now, suppose I put in the soft mode of that mean field theory. Then I end up with the familiar U1 gauge theory, which everybody has been looking at, where we have the system describe bosons, fermions, which carry spin, which has undergo the D-wave pairing, and also bosons. They couple together via this U1 gauge field. Now, this U1 gauge field has the effect that it restores the local gauge symmetry. Namely, if you transform the bosons and the fermion in a site-dependent way under a U1 transformation, in the presence of this gauge field, this symmetry is respected. Okay, so this is the gauge theory, which includes the so the gauge field is there to enforce the constraint in a space-time local fashion, and the boson has a modulus and a phase, and the fermion pairing amplitude has a modulus and a phase. Those are the soft modes of the problem. One gauge, one U1 gauge field.
And the superconducting.
We have we have the superconducting order parameter, which is a modulus and a phase.
So that's one gauge.
Yeah. But no, I don't call that a gauge field. It's just
the phase is what is the phase?
It's
U1.
It is.
It's a degree of freedom.
Yeah. It is. Yeah. Okay. So then we have the boson modulus and phase, which is another U1 degree of freedom, and then we have a U1 gauge field coupling them. Well, I don't call those things a gauge field.
Two order parameters.
Two U1 order parameter and one gauge field. No, right. The boson, in this gauge theory, the order parameter is purely for F. No, it's the pairing order parameter for F. I'm sorry, it's not an electron superconducting order parameter.
It's just a spin gap phase.
Huh? No, not yet. Do I make myself clear here? You know, we have a fermion which pairs, and whose pairing amplitude can have a phase and a modulus. And the phase is a dynamical variable. I quench the modulus, fluctuation. I did not allow the modulus to fluctuate, which is a approximation. Now the boson is a U1 scalar field, which has a modulus and a phase, whose phase can fluctuate. And then there's a U1 gauge field linking them together.
Just
Don, it's a question here. Sorry, I mean, if you take that delta zero e to the I theta term, f dagger, f dagger, what if you just, what stops me just saying, I don't need theta as a dynamical field, and I just add f dagger term? There's no physical symmetries precluding that. I mean, electromagnetic U1 and spin SU2, and that, I mean, that is what breaks it down to the symmetry, right?
By eliminating the spin. Huh? I don't see the spin field in that.
You don't see what?
The spin field, only that I had before, non-maximum.
No, no, I don't have the spin field here. Right. I mean, the here I'm concentrating. No, that's not what he's saying. That's not what. No.
You know, if you wanted to put all terms allowed by physical symmetries using these variables, you're allowed to put just an f dagger term with no dynamical field out front in the IP. Right? It doesn't violate charge, electromagnetic charge conservation, spin rotation. So just the term that's allowed by physical symmetries. When written in terms of these variables, it seems like all terms allowed by symmetry are going to be there, and this is some fine tuning going on. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, that takes you from a U margin symmetry now to a Z2 symmetry. Mm-hmm. And those terms of those variables, if you write down all the terms allowed by physical symmetries, you have a Z2 symmetry.
Well, in general,
there's no good U1 gauge symmetry is an artifact. And, you know, I mean, okay, we made up as a computational device that only calculates something.
Well, if I insist on that delta doesn't have any phase, I guess that amounts to I would choose, you know, here because both theta and, you know, the everything is coupled to a U1 gauge field. I can choose to absorb this phase inside the, you know, into the U1 gauge field.
Murphy suggests that we have a term there that we have a delta which is purely real plus maybe some other properties.
F dagger on site or you
like Yeah, I mean, if I take this to be pure real.
Yeah.
And I still have a U1 gauge field here. I don't think that would change anything.
Right, and you have two gauge fields instead of three.
But you don't have a U1 symmetry anymore, that's what I'm saying. There's no U1 gauge symmetry left. And let's put him on site, F I up dagger, F I down dagger.
Yeah.
I mean, it's allowed
by
physical symmetries, but it breaks the U1 gauge symmetry down to a T2.
We cannot do the gauge tensor.
So, within the sort of philosophy of working with these effective fields, B and F, and saying all terms that are allowed by symmetry will generically be there, one has to fine tune to get a symmetry as high as the U1 gauge symmetry
directs him towards these fields.
Yeah. I mean, in fact, the way
I. Small, I might be small, but it's going to always be non zero.
Yeah, my view of this is that the mean field theory is actually a saddle point of some Hubbard-Stratonovich decoupling, and in this Hubbard-Stratonovich decoupling, those auxiliary field in general will carry a modulus and a phase, and in order for me to faithfully represent the path integral, I have to, you know, allow this quantity to have a modulus and a phase. I cannot force them to only have a modulus, not a phase.
There's a comment that one can make that may perhaps clarify what's happening.
It is
true that this U1 gate symmetry was just more or less put in by hand. It's a question of how did it.
No, it's not totally fair to say it is put in by hand. You know, you can imagine this is what you are doing. You take the TJ model, okay, and you dictate it by the mean field. You have a Stratonovich fashion.
But it's in some particular representation that you chose to make, okay, which is the slave boson thing.
Yeah.
And the physical system, of course, doesn't know that it has any U1 gates. That's a question of your description.
Yes.
Okay? And so the point, I guess, is that since it's a question of your description, you can always choose to work with a less redundant description.
Mm-hmm.
And in this particular case, a less redundant description, which would still give you all the correct physics, is to, you can get rid of this extra U1 redundancy,
mm-hmm.
Which is basically the space of this along the pavement and the street.
Okay,
and
yeah.
Just work with a Z2 redundancy.
Okay.
And that would be a little bit of frequency.
Okay, what you're
suggesting using a sort of Ising variable to be talking.
Yeah.
No, no, the Heisenberg model, you can write the Heisenberg no. model as a Z2 gauge theory,
but,
right? So you don't need the
Okay, but you know, what you say can very well be true, but you know, I start from a action, I have a strategy in you know, making a mean field approximation and then include the soft mode on top of that. What you require might need another, you know, type of decoupling, which is not what I'm doing.
Okay. No, I mean, let's say you start with this action, right? I agree that if you start with your mean field description, then you'd have to keep all these degrees of freedom,
yeah.
and so on.
Yeah.
But then, one can demonstrate quite easily that this phase field theta ij,
yes.
Basically just represents more or less redundant degrees of freedom, which decouples from the remaining part of the action, which has the physical degrees of freedom.
Yeah.
And if those can, I mean, the and the remaining physical sector of the theory really involves only Z2 gates.
Okay. No, but
all the space field theta ij is associated with an unphysical sector of the theory, which is redundant. It can be integrated out completely.
Yeah, yeah, that's what I'm doing. Yeah, that's what I'm doing.
Okay. So
I'm not saying that in the physical sector, you know, what happens. You know, at this moment, I'm trying very hard to actually to remove the redundant degree of freedom.
The gauge symmetry is a redundancy. Yeah, so you guys are in agreement?
Yeah. It's a question of how redundant you want your description to be.
There's a minimal amount of redundancy that you need, if you use these variables, if you choose to use these and Fs, there's a minimal amount of redundancy you need. And the U1 and the SU2, you've added more redundancy than you need. Okay.
But sometimes adding gauge symmetries clarifies things. Sometimes it doesn't. Okay.
Exactly.
Let's move on.
Sure.
Okay. This lattice gauge theory, we haven't been able to make progress precisely on the lattice. What we were able to do is we take a low energy version of this lattice gauge theory. Namely, we take a continuum limit of this theory. What I'm going to say, the result I'm going to report to you, you know, of course, this jump from the lattice from a discrete lattice theory to a continuum, that's usually can be where a lot of the rich physics got, you know, thrown out. So whether, you know, this continuum theory represents this lattice theory or not, I guess is the most important question. And anyhow, I take the continuum limit of this lattice theory. The continuum limit, let me just describe to you how would they look like. So here, we basically have a fermion, a paired fermion system coupled to a bosonic system through a U1 gauge field. So in the continuum limit at long wavelengths and low energy, I take that is the boson phase fluctuation, the soft mode in the boson sector. And in the fermion sector, I take it is the spin-on pairs. Spin-on pairs is a boson field also. So there is a phase fluctuation of the spin-on pair, which is the soft mode. Just like the boson phase factor is the soft mode. Then I take that in the fermion sector, there's additional broken fermion excitation, which are the nodal quasiparticles. So these three excitation constitute in the ingredient of my continuum theory, and they are coupled by the gauge field.
So you're assuming that the magnitude of the spin-on pairing field is effectively fixed.
That's right. That's correct. That's correct. Assumption. That's correct.
Which is part of the trajectory.
It's probably a good assumption.
But it's the spin gap phase.
Yeah, on the top trajectory.
Okay, so how much time do I have?
Well, you've been talking about an hour, but it's been a lot of discussion. How much time do you need?
Well, and Susanna, how much detail you want to know? Okay. Why don't we take a vote? Should I go through the detail or just tell you the result? The result is published, so.
No one reads.
Okay. All right, so why don't I go through them then? Okay. So then, in more specifically, this is the action of the boson field, and here, you know, this is a canonical low energy superfluid like action. So this 5B is a U1 scalar. It's a unimodular field e to the I theta. Okay, so this is a compact U1. Phase factor, and so this term is what we usually call the phase stiffness constant of superfluid, and this little a is this U1 gauge field, and capital A is the zero physical electromagnetic.
So that's your charge E B boson.
Those are my charge E B bosons, and this term is the Barry phase term due to the fact that I have a constant density, constant average density. And here is the interaction term, which is the time, in the time direction. In the case where the interaction is local, I would just have a local interaction. But since I have a Coulomb interaction, so I have to have a kernel, which is inverse of the Coulomb interaction. So this is the boson sector. Now here is the pair, the spin-on sector. So the paired spin-on sector, you can think of it as a paired dimer, RVD, if you like. So this is the paired fermion field. The paired fermion field has a solved phase fluctuation too, with a stiffness. And because this object is a paired fermion, so it coupled to the little a by twice of the charge. And in this formula, then the Coulomb interaction is entirely cast upon the boson. So the fermion pair doesn't interact with the long-range Coulomb interaction. And again, the fermion field, the pair field has average density, so there's a Barry phase term also. And then finally, we have this nodal quasi-particle excitation, which is Dirac-like, and there are two species reflecting two different nodes, and they have linear dispersion. And then finally, we have the coupling between the nodal quasi-particle and the pair fermion field. Remember that at the mean field level, these three actions. The pair fermion field plus the Dirac nodal quasi-particle plus the interaction basically is the same action which you will write down for a conventional D-wave electron superconductor. Just view the fermions as electrons, except that they couple to the fictitious gauge field A nu, and they couple to the boson field. And if I take the mean field theory result, I will get the boson phase stiffness constant to be proportional to doping and hopping, and the fermion phase stiffness constant is proportional to J, and the boson compressibility, inverse compressibility is proportional to J A squared. So now, with this theory, in fact, you can see that in this theory, everywhere this little a only appear in most quadratic form. So it's either linear or quadratic. So you can actually integrate out A formally exactly at this point.
I mean, this is because you're in the continuum limit, I guess.
This is the continuum limit. Yeah. After you integrate out the gauge field, exactly, you find that the boson U1 phase factor and the pair fermion U1 phase factor coalesce in such a way that phi b squared phi bar and form a U1 scalar. This is the only variable which will appear in the final action. And this final variable coupled to the external gauge field via coupling constant 2, so it carries charge 2. And as you can see, nowhere in this final action is this fictitious U1 gauge field. So this object, I identify it as the condensate phase factor. Now, then here we have the quasi-particle Dirac Hamiltonian. Due to the integrating of the gauge degree of freedom away, two new terms are added to the quasi-particle Hamiltonian. They cause effective quasi-particle interaction. In the current case, we have a current-current interaction which is local, and in the case of density, if it will not because of the long-range cooling interaction, this will be local too. But in the presence of long-range cooling interaction, this has B in it. The precise
is
the F, which I wrote down in this transparency. Okay, so
yes,
so I'm sorry.
It's not multiplied by a boson. It's not gauged by.
Yeah. No. But no. Wait a minute. My final electronic field is not proportional to psi. It's proportional to the superconducting phase factor e to the I phi over 2 times this psi. Yeah.
But
psi is actually. Yeah. So here is
the F. But half of your spin on pair field has gotten glued onto F to give you psi, basically.
Isn't it? That's. Sorry, say that again.
Psi is F bound to
psi.
No,
psi.
Psi is the broken spin-on excitation.
Yeah, so it's F both to half.
It's a broken spin-on pair excitation.
It's F, but then neutralized with respect to the U1 gauge.
That's right.
So
that's right.
Like you can think of it as half spin-on pair.
Yeah. In fact, F, yeah, you know, the F here is the original F in the lattice theory screened by the condensate.
Yeah. So it's like bound to half a spin-on pair condensate. Yeah.
No, once you do this screening, you know, there's no more change in psi. I apologize, the psi here is related to the original F in the slate boson representation by a gauge transformation.
I mean, in the Z2 gauge theory formulation,
mm-hmm.
your psi is our F.
So I'm saying your
precise
U1 gauge neutral.
Yeah. Because it doesn't couple to the U1 gauge potential minimally. I mean, it's
it does carry
a
Z2 gauge charge.
So you multiply E to the I phi over 2 times the phase of the spin-on pair by 2 or something.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. That's right.
Halving the spin-on pair operators, what it uses. Another redundancy, which is
the Z2. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now you have three parameters. You have a condensate amplitude, you have a spin-on gap, and you have this B delta. Mm-hmm. Are these all three connected like it would be in the VCS case? Or they
sorry, separate? Say that again.
You have the velocity of the gap around the node.
Yeah.
You have the condensate amplitude, and you have a spin-on gap parameter.
Yeah.
Are these all connected like in the VCS sense, or are they? Are they independent?
Well, the velocity, the in the spin-on sectors, for example, the velocity near the node is only connected to the spin-on pair. All the parameters is totally independent of the boson sector.
I thought you, now you've gotten rid of the spin-ons because you have these upsides which have the boson
No, this, no.
These are electromagnetically neutral.
These are like the superconductor, they carry no charge. They carry spin, but no charge. These are not the bare electrical.
Okay, so. Anyway, another important effect of the integrating of the U1 gauge degree of freedom is that the.
You said there were some residual interactions there.
Yeah.
This one was like four fermion interactions.
Those are four fermion interactions.
They are local.
Well, in the absence of Coulomb interaction, they are both local. The current interaction is always local, but the density interaction could be have a 1 over RP.
The psi fermion doesn't carry an electromagnetic charge.
Yeah, but.
So I can have a 1 over R.
Yeah, but this is partly, I think, is due to the screening of the condensate. I mean, this is. So here we have, let's see, for very small Q, then this is going to be dominated by this term.
When you
talk
about a constant,
I
hear
it's
a little
constant.
Yeah, which is okay.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah,
because for very small Q, it is a long distance screen. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah.
So this is
for small Q, it is
You said that you formally integrate that exactly.
Right? Yeah.
What you end up is non-local in time and space actions. Or in other words, you can get.
Well, this is not
non-trivial frequency.
Not really non-local.
Why would it be local if you have low-lying excitations in your fermion domain?
Well, I'm not integrating out the low-lying fermion excitation.
Right.
The fermion excitation, whatever low line, is still there.
Okay, but you get like effective Green's functions of fermions as your coupling constant.
No. I only integrate out the U1 gauge field. I did not integrate over the matter degree of freedom.
This looks like the effective action of the D-wave superconductor.
Yeah.
So it has a condensate part, and it has a quasi particle, which looks like the Dirac particle.
Yeah.
But you get inverse of derivatives, right? Because you're probably not having derivatives. Anyway, it's a technical question.
Yeah. I mean, so now you have no spin charge separation, which is back to the standard D-wave superconductor.
Well, I mean, we have to be careful. Spin charge separation, not in the most naive sense. Namely, you have this slave boson. If you view slave boson and this original fermion decouple as spin charge separation, then I don't have that. But it does have, in this case, due to the pairing, there's a charge mode, which is basically the superconducting condensate is capable of transporting the charge. And the neutral fermion carry the spin. And whether you will have a decoupling of the superconducting phase degree of freedom and this neutral fermion, that's another issue.
But it just gives gives finally at the bottom a conventional description of a BCS superconductor, right?
No, because you see, you are near a Mott insulator. You need to know what's the impact of Mott insulator, for example, on the superfluid density, and for example, on the quasi-particle charge. On the Fermi, velocity.
Your condensate does not transport the electrons anymore. It's transporting the holes. You're saying 1 over lambda squared would be a proportionate number of holes. Not the number of electrons.
Right, that's correct. That's
in
correct.
In that sense, it's different than a BCS.
Right, that's correct. So here, we can see very explicitly that the super fluid density end up as proportional to the doping concentration x, not proportional to the original electron density. Yeah. And also, we see that the current, which coupled this quasi-particle current to the to the phase grading of the superconducting order parameter is no longer 1. It also suffers a reduction. Finally, this coefficient is also proportional to x. That's also different from a conventional BCS superconducting.
Are these k's similar to the k's that you calculated back in the late 80s in the U1 theory? Because yours is scaled like x as well. Right?
Yeah, in fact, when the superfluid stiffness goes to 0, you approach a mass transition at the number of holes, is a very general statement.
Yeah.
It's just proximity to a Mach insulator, you don't have Galilean invariance, the charge has to get screened. I mean, if you want to interpret it in a sort of Fermi liquid way, you have to assume something about F1, which is the Fermi liquid parameter which downgrades your current and tells you that when you get to the Mach insulator, the electron cannot move. So I think the results are consistent with what we're getting then.
Superconducting phase you're describing, it is smoothly connected to a conventional relay.
I don't think there's any symmetry difference between the two.
I don't see that because if it's condensated, the force of the number of holes, not force of the number of electrons, how do you smoothly connect the two?
The superfluid density or the contact fraction are non-universal quantities. I mean, I guess when we're saying it's got all of the universal qualitative properties of a BCS superconductor once you're in this phase. I mean, now you make a decision about how big is the superfluid density when you dope and so forth. Those are interesting, important issues, but that doesn't mean that the actual phase that he's describing once he's in it is qualitatively distinct from the phase you get when you just do BCS.
You would say that there would not be any sort of quantum critical point when you would dope the superfluid.
No, I'm just talking about the phase itself.
I'm talking about the phase.
Yeah. You would say there's no distinction. I mean, it would not be a quantum critical point when you would go from the superfluid or the superconductor with the stiffness proportion to the number of density of holes and the one proportion to the density of electrons.
There's no symmetry difference.
There's no need for it. I mean, one could imagine superconducting being different.
Yeah.
I mean, there are larger normalizations of the parameters.
Yeah. Okay, since Catherine gave me the sign, I should stop. But I want to stop in pointing out the final theory is actually describing a bunch of pairs which are moving in the presence of hosts. So if you like, it is like resonating valence patterns of the pairs. And on top of that, there are nodal quasi-particle excitations where the energy gap disappears. And this theory, because of the Mott constraint, gives you a superfluid density quite low. However, the fermions pairing amplitude is not suffered by this Mott insulating renormalization. And the pairing amplitude can still be a fraction, say 10% of J. So in principle, if X is very low, there could be a far separation between the pairing scale and the phase coherence scale. And hence, in principle, this theory is capable of describing a pseudo gap. And then finally, if I write the electron operators in terms of the operator in the final theory, it is square root of the superconducting phase factor times the neutral fermion operator. And I guess the question of whether this 2 degree of freedom can separate or not is is what Matthew and Santo were concentrating on. So
you're saying that a quasi particle wave in the series is a portion of the superconducting condensate.
I'm sorry?
So you're saying there's a relationship between the quasi particle wave and the superfluid wave?
I wouldn't go that far. First of all, this two is not completely decoupled. If this two were decoupled, if I were allowed, suppose I compute the electron single particle Green's function, suppose I were allowed to factorize it into this phase-phase correlation function and this neutral fermion correlation, then indeed, you would claim that the coherent part of the quasi-particle weight is proportional to the superconducting condensate fraction.
But they're coupled by gauge field.
Yeah. Right? No.
If they're not.
It's the Doppler shift term which
would couple. Inside the superconducting gauge. Yeah,
I'm talking about inside the superconducting gauge. Well, there are experiments which near the anti-node point where the coherent part of the spectral weight grow up only inside the superconducting phase.
You have no anti-node
quasi particle. No, I have no anti-node quasi particle. If I were forced to stretch, what I would say is the following: because near the anti-node, the Fermi velocity is the smallest. So what happens there? The Doppler shift, the coupling between the phase degree of freedom and the neutral fermion degree of freedom is the smallest. And in the nodal region, it's exactly the opposite. So perhaps, from that point of view, perhaps if there's any sense in decoupling, it's in the anti-node region. Okay, so I have spent a long time. I think I should stop. In summary, what I did was we start from a pretty straightforward and naive mean field theory, but amazingly is that it captured many of the ordering tendencies of the cuprate. And starting from those mean field theory, after we identify the low energy degree of freedom, at least in two regimes, we can make some progress in addressing the low energy physics. But of course, the important question is then what is, within this framework, how do we understand the anomalous anomalous transport properties, and how do we understand the low energy effective theory in the stripe region, and all of this is out of our hand at the moment. Thank you very much for your attention.